Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show. China is facing a second wave of the coronavirus. Meantime, in Canada, longstanding episodes of police violence towards Indigenous people addressed once again.
It doesn't stop. It hasn't stopped. Day in and day out.
Also in Canada, with millions out of work during the pandemic, Ottawa is considering paying people a government stipend, no questions asked. They've already tried it on a temporary basis.
It's really empowered us. It's done more than just pay the bills. It's given us a little bit of freedom that we've never really felt before.
And North Korea sends a message to South Korea by blowing up its own building, a symbol of North-South cooperation.
Today, in the middle of the afternoon here on the Korean Peninsula, suddenly there were plumes of smoke rising from Kaesong. That's a North Korean city.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to be back with you. We've been hearing the warnings for months. Don't get too complacent that a second wave of coronavirus infections will almost certainly happen. That's now become a reality in China. In Beijing, dozens of cases have re-emerged in the past few days. And China's capital is now reintroducing strict lockdown measures and mass testing for the virus to try and contain it. Beijing officials are warning that the risk of things spreading in the city of 21 million are extremely severe. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai. How widespread is this latest outbreak, Rebecca? Where did it actually start?
Well, you know, people in Beijing had started to relax a bit in recent weeks. You know, schools had started to reopen and there weren't as many temperature checks and all these measures. But after 50 days of no new cases, they started to emerge from this Xinfadi Pifa Shichang, which is a really large wholesale food market in the southern part of Beijing. So there were several cases that emerged, all having some kind of contact with that market. And this strain of the virus is different from the one that had been spreading through China before. This one has a European origin, and it was found on cutting boards used for imported salmon.
Wow. So what measures are now being taken in response to this new outbreak?
Xu Junwei, who's the local mayor of Beijing's Fengtai district, had this to say at the end of last week at a press conference. What he's saying is that the response is going to be like a wartime response. And there were also videos on social media showing soldiers with masks and goggles marching near the market. They really, I think, moved fast to try to contain the spread of the virus. So on the weekend, they collected samples from more than 76,000 people near the market. They closed the market. They put 11 housing communities in the area around the market on complete lockdown. So no one can go in and no one can go out. And they closed down several schools that were in the area. But that's just one district, and there's 16 districts in Beijing, and they're starting to find cases outside of that area. So people are feeling the tightening of restrictions again.
Rebecca, is the sense that this spike in cases is happening because lockdown restrictions have eased up in China and in other countries? I mean, is that connection being made?
Yeah, so it's puzzling because the borders are still closed. There's no people coming in or out of the country. So that makes it kind of curious where these cases came from. I think they're watching very closely. I think people in Beijing are prepping themselves for tightening of restrictions, you can just sort of see it coming. Restaurants are closing down again. Events are closing down again. Yesterday, China's chief epidemiologist, Wu Zhongyao, gave a very extended interview on national television to address people's concerns.
那么未来三天，北京报告的病例数决定了。
So he said basically this week, really in the next few days, is going to be crucial to controlling the spread of the virus. And he said that he thought the authorities had caught the outbreak early, but he was going to be watching very closely to see how fast the numbers rise, because people will start showing symptoms in the next few days. So if the numbers don't increase much, then you can say that things have stabilized. But this is the crucial time, he said.
So a new little cluster of differentiated coronavirus, people will see new measures taken in response. How are people reacting to just the news? Are they worried right now?
I think people are worried, but, you know, people here have been dealing with this for months. You know, the restrictions have been on for months. So I think they're probably frustrated, too, because, you know, it's like one step forward, two steps back.
The World's correspondent in Shanghai, Rebecca Canther. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Governments everywhere are scrambling for ways to soften the economic blow of the pandemic. In Canada, millions of people who've lost their jobs or gotten sick because of the coronavirus have applied for emergency financial assistance. Those who qualify are getting $2,000 Canadian a month. The program has become a necessary lifeline for many people. Now some Canadians are asking, should these payments be permanent? Leading once again to talk about universal basic income. Anita Elash has more from Toronto.
This is my backyard right now, where my chickens free range.
Beverly Harlow is obviously in her happy place as she wanders among the poultry that's taken over her backyard in Lindsay, Ontario, northeast of Toronto.
The ducklings like to follow me around the yard, so that's kind of fun.
She expects that over the next few months, all these ducklings and chickens will produce a rainbow assortment of eggs, enough to feed the family and send the surplus to a local food bank.
They'll be blue, green. I have one breed that does pink, and white, brown, and olive-colored eggs as well. So I'm really excited about that.
Harlow and her family have lived here for 4 years. But until this spring, they could never afford to raise chickens. She says their combined salaries barely covered the bills. They themselves relied on the food bank. But Harlow lost her job as a telemarketer and online sales rep after the coronavirus hit. That qualified her for a $2,000 a month emergency jobless benefit from the Canadian government. Now, Harlow tells me on the phone, the family is doing really well. They've planted a vegetable garden, painted the kitchen, and even made room for a homeless teenager.
It's really empowered us. It's done more than just pay the bills. It's given us options, and it's given us a little bit of freedom that we've never really felt before.
The Canadian Emergency Jobless Benefit is a temporary program, but it's also turned into what may be the world's largest experiment with a universal basic income. More than 8 million Canadians have applied for it, and many economists and politicians say it's proof the time has finally come for a no-strings-attached guaranteed income. Economic historian Wayne Luchuk is one of them.
We really need to see basic income as a modern policy for a modern labor market.
Luchuk was one of the experts hired to monitor a recent universal basic income experiment in Ontario, Canada's largest province. In that case, the government enrolled 4,000 low-income earners in a pilot project. But less than halfway through, a provincial election brought in a new government and the experiment was canceled. There were no definitive results, but earlier this year, Luchuk and a team of researchers surveyed 200 participants.
Bottom line is it was a great success for the people who were on the pilot.
He says a majority smoked less, drank less, ate better, stayed healthier, and kept their jobs. A third even got new, better-paying work.
It gave them a floor below which they couldn't fall, so therefore they had more confidence and security. And it meant that they could either go out and look for a better job, take a chance on a better job, or they could advance their training and get more education.
With so much economic damage caused by the coronavirus pandemic, Luchuk argues that this kind of safety net will become more important than ever. Back in Lindsay, Ontario, Beverly Harlow says she used to think the idea of a basic universal income was a joke, but her own experience has changed her mind completely.
Worrying about if you're going to eat or pay hydro really breaks you down, and it puts you in this cage mentally that you can't think past because you're constantly thinking about the money. Whereas now, I've thought the cage is gone and I can think bigger.
She still hasn't found a new job and says she'd like to go back to school.
We're growing and we're cultivating a future, and that money is just really empowered. Like, the word empower is just all I can say about it, right?
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced today that Canada's emergency response benefit will be extended for another 2 months. He said the pandemic is an unprecedented challenge for the country, and a lot of people need this support while they look for work. For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Toronto.
The pandemic has led to other experiments and reminded us that we already have some useful tools to cope economically. Remote working, cloud computing, robotics and automation, the reliance on these things during lockdown may very well stick in a post-pandemic world. There will be winners, says Mohit Joshi, president of Infosys Limited in London, and he says some companies are already ahead of the curve.
So I think these companies are doing a couple of things, right? I think they're taking a very hard look at their technology infrastructure to see if they have the scalability and the security to allow them to function in the first place. They're looking to see if their technology infrastructure allows their employees to be able to work productively from outside the office. They're taking a close look at the user journeys, right, for both employees and for customers. They're taking a very close look at their cost structures, right? Will their cost structures hold up post-pandemic?
So you're talking essentially a doubling down of remote working, right?
Look, I think remote working is going to be a fact of life for a fairly long time. I don't think we will ever get to 100% work from home. You know, for most companies, there will be some sort of a hybrid model in which things will operate.
What about manufacturing, where workers do not have a choice but to go to the assembly line? Like, what are the industries do you see struggling or not surviving?
I think that there is going to be a boom in shop floor automation and in warehouse automation. And clearly, the larger companies, the one with, you know, greater operational resilience and greater financial resilience, will move ahead.
So, Mohit, we've spoken about businesses themselves and economies, but what about the workers? I mean, there's an unprecedented level of unemployment and economic pain right now. What needs to be done to protect the workers, the people, and get millions of them back to work?
The cure for this, the ultimate cure for this, will not be found in economics or by governments. The solution has to be found by the pharma industry in the short run through a treatment regime that helps people who are infected with COVID, and the medium to long run with the vaccine, right? But even in, you know, I would say that even if you look at the past month and a half, we have seen much higher levels of economic activity than we did in the immediate aftermath of the crisis. So hopefully with a mix of prudent reopening by businesses, government intervention to support the level of economic activity, and the pharma interventions should help workers get out of the very deep hole that has been dug.
Mohit, I got to say, you sound fairly optimistic about the future. What do you worry about?
So I think what everybody worries about is a second, maybe more virulent strain of the pandemic. I think the second piece is that while governments have been very open with their liquidity taps and with the income support and grant taps, clearly there will be some pain for the banks in the medium to long run as loan losses start to crystallize. So a potential medium to long-term risk to the financial system is something that we should be looking out for. Having said that, I have to say that the financial system has actually held up very well. From my own personal perspective, right, when the pandemic hit, I actually withdrew more cash from the ATM, thinking that, you know, cash is probably a good thing to have just now. But in most places, including my local grocery store, you can't use cash, right? People are only using contactless cards. So the way the financial services business and the way the technology business have ramped up, I think has been, you know, fairly impressive.
Mohit Joshi, president of Infosys Limited in London. Mohit, great to have you discussing this with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Just ahead, Chinese and Indian soldiers get into a deadly fistfight on their border. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. North Korea blew up one of its own buildings today, the Inter-Korean Liaison Office, where officials met with South Korean counterparts. It's a symbol of North-South cooperation that opened 2 years ago. That era of feel-good relations, though, between the Koreas is definitely taking a turn right now. The big question is where that turn is taking us. Reporter Jason Strother joins me from Seoul, South Korea. So it appears that no one was hurt in this explosion, Jason. What happened?
The Joint Liaison Office had been closed since the end of January because of the coronavirus pandemic. But just a few days ago, Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jung, who's more or less now the face of the regime, she spoke through the North's official media saying that, you know, the regime was going to demolish the liaison office. And she wasn't kidding around. Soon, South Korea's Ministry of Unification and then later North Korea confirmed that it had blown up.
Yeah, I mean, to literally blow up this liaison office, the symbol of cooperation seems really discouraging. What are the North Koreans saying about why they did this?
For the past few weeks, North Korea has been lashing out at South Korea over North Korean defectors and other human rights groups sending balloons filled with anti-regime propaganda over the border. Kim Yo-jung, the ruler's younger sister, has called these defectors human scum, betrayers, riffraff, and has ordered South Korea more or less to crack down on them. So ostensibly, that's the reason why North Korea launched this provocation. But I think most observers think that's just a ruse, that something else is going on. It could be anger over continuing UN sanctions against the regime, or just the failure to make any progress with South Korea or the United States.
So in recent years, the political atmospherics, at least, between North and South Korea have been pretty cordial. But if the North has decided that the South is now an enemy again, what does that mean for the South Korean government?
Right, Marco. It's a really tough position for President Moon Jae-in, who, you know, came to power in 2017 with big promises to officially draw up a peace treaty to end the soon-to-be 70-year-old Korean War. He, in 2018, you had, you know, it was a year of rapprochement. You had summits between Moon Jae-in, Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump. But now all those efforts seem to have gone to waste. This liaison office was more or less an embassy between Pyongyang and Seoul. Officials from both countries worked and lived there. They worked together. They were there all the time together. And now that's all gone.
So you mentioned the anger over the defectors to the South. Why would North Korea decide, though, now is the time to be more public about South Korea the enemy?
Anyone who tells you that they know why North Korea does what it does when it does is lying. So we can only speculate what were North Korea's motives for lashing out now at the defectors. Mm-hmm. These groups have been sending leaflets and USB sticks, dollar bills, South Korean drama DVDs over the border for well over a decade. And of course, North Korea has expressed anger about that before, but North Korea was also sending its own leaflets, southbound too for a long time. So now it kind of remains to be seen why North Korea, you know, latched on to this one particular, you know, aspect. It said that, you know, the defectors were, you know, in violation of the goodwill and the good spirits that the leaders agreed to back in 2018. Seoul is now cracking down on these defector groups. Mm. They have said they are policing the border to make sure these groups don't send over their leaflets.
Jason Strother is speaking with us from Seoul, South Korea. Thanks very much, Jason, as always.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Soldiers of the world's two most populous nations came to blows yesterday. Chinese troops killed at least 20 members of India's army. The soldiers were not shot. They were killed in a brawl involving rocks and wooden clubs. Details are still emerging. There are unconfirmed reports of casualties on the Chinese side as well. Tensions have been flaring up in recent weeks between India and China along their disputed mountain border. Both sides accuse the other of occupying new territory, and both have rushed up reinforcements. Taylor Fravel is director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. I asked him for his take.
So it's still unclear, but in some area, which is called the Galwan River Valley, Chinese and Indian troops got into a fistfight. It apparently happened in the middle of the night. And as you noted in your intro, Indian soldiers were killed. There are also unconfirmed reports that perhaps 34 Indian soldiers were temporarily detained by the Chinese. And there are also, of course, reports that China suffered casualties as well.
So the border there, I mean, this is a very tough theater of operations, several miles up in the clouds in the Himalayas. Why are China and India even facing off?
So China and India have disputed the entire stretch of their border since the 1950s. They fought a war over this land in 1962. There was a very violent clash over a small piece of this land in 1967 and a really, really tense crisis in 1986 and 1987.
So it sounds like over the years there have been several conflagrations, but I mean, it all comes back to why there's no clearly defined border. I mean, this whole term, line of actual control, that sounds like kind of a sop. Why is there no clearly defined border?
Because neither side can make the concessions needed to bring about a clearly defined border. The basic situation has been a trade for what is known as the Eastern Sector for the Western Sector. So the Western sector is basically fully under Chinese control. The Eastern sector is completely under Indian control. So the basic settlement would be a swap of some sort. But politically, it's very difficult, especially in India, which is a vibrant democracy, and public opinion around the China issue is quite intense. China, I think, also is increasingly less likely in the last decade or so, and especially the last 5 years under Xi Jinping, to want to soften its stance on any sovereignty issue. And so China, you know, has sort of taken a much more assertive approach recently in the last, you know, 6 to 12 months towards Taiwan and the South China Sea, of course, over Hong Kong and other areas. And so it's not just the case that India is reluctant today to sort of make the compromises necessary. I'm not sure anymore if China would be in a position to do so either.
So 1962, there was that brief but bloody war. Things have stabilized over the past decades. But now both countries, India and China, have nuclear weapons. How serious is the danger of escalation right now?
I still think the danger of escalation is pretty small. For the following reasons. First, this dispute is happening at a high altitude area, right, where it's actually hard to amass large numbers of troops. I mean, there was significant fighting in 1962, but importantly, it didn't last very long because conditions weren't conducive for a sort of a large scale military operation. And if we're not going to see a large scale military operation, ultimately, the incentives or the pressures to use nuclear weapons would be much less. Also, in this case, China and India both have what are described as no first use policies, which means that neither side will be the first to use nuclear weapons. Now, given the relatively sort of fixed scale of the dispute, right, this is not a question of a total war erupting between the two countries. It's not a question of China trying to, you know, take the Indian capital, or it's not a question of India trying to go in and take all of Xinjiang or something like that, right? This is still a very sort of defined area. It's very worrisome whenever you have a conflict between two nuclear armed powers. I don't want to downplay that, but there's certainly also a sense, right, that this is a limited conflict between two very large countries. And so I guess I would stress the fact that it is still a limited conflict.
Taylor Fravel, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You tune into The World every weekday to hear stories that connect you to the world. That connection continues online. Join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking, share them, and find our team of journalists. Follow us on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. A South African broadcaster talks about race in a way that makes his interview guests squirm a little. Now he wants to hear from white Americans.
Do you feel the burden of history in terms of being implemented in intergenerational injustice, even if you weren't around when slavery started?
Tough times, tough questions, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Police brutality in Canada is nothing new, but anger over continued use of excessive force among police is growing in Canada. It's not just a reaction to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Recent dash cam footage shows Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers assaulting an Indigenous chief. It's one of many recent incidents of police violence against Indigenous and Black people in Canada. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy.
From the start, you can see that Alan Adam is angry and frustrated. In the dashcam video, the outspoken chief of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation in northern Alberta has been stopped by some officers from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP, for an expired license plate.
I'm tired of being harassed by the
RCMP, Adam says. The situation suddenly escalates when an officer who runs in from off-screen launches himself at Adam, tackling him to the ground and punching him in the head. The incident happened in March, but the video was released as part of a court case last week as protests sparked by the death of George Floyd spread across Canada. Amid the ensuing public outrage, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canada had not done enough to address the treatment of Indigenous people.
We have made steps to improve it, but there is a need for much more, much quicker.
Trudeau acknowledged that there is systemic racism in Canada. Other Canadian leaders, though, seemed reluctant to go that far. Ontario Premier Doug Ford at first said Canada doesn't have the same systemic deep roots of racism as the United States. After criticism, he walked those comments back. The RCMP commissioner also at first said her organization wasn't systemically racist before clarifying that systemic racism does exist at the RCMP.
You know, it's very disheartening because, you know, it's all been talked. There hasn't been much action.
Lorraine Whitman is president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. She points out that it's now been a year since the release of a 1,200-page groundbreaking report into missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. It concluded that thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been killed or have disappeared as a result of what they called Canadian genocide. The report found that these deaths and disappearances weren't properly investigated because of systemic bias within the police force. The Canadian government promised to have a national action plan in place by this month, but it's been delayed.
This has happened for years and years, and they need to take it seriously. We need to be heard, and we aren't being heard.
Meanwhile, troubling cases involving police and Indigenous people continue to make news. Recently, a Black and Indigenous woman died when she fell from a balcony while Toronto police were in her apartment. Another Indigenous woman was shot and killed by police in Edmonton conducting a well-being check. In New Brunswick, officers fatally shot an Indigenous man. Norm Leach is executive director of the Vancouver Aboriginal Community Policing Center.
It's an uphill battle, especially when it doesn't stop. It hasn't stopped. It goes on and on.
Leach's group gets 3 hours with new officers in Vancouver to train them on interacting with Indigenous people. He says they explain that Indigenous people still see the RCMP in an historical context that isn't fully acknowledged.
When they created the RCMP, or originally the Northwest Mounted Police, well, their job was to police the frontier, which meant us.
This moment could be different, though, Leach says, but not because of any acknowledgement or promises by the Canadian government. Instead, Leach says this time could mean real change because of the momentum behind protests in both the Black and Indigenous communities.
I think it's a natural alliance.
And Black and Indigenous communities have allied throughout history, even though colonial powers have tried to separate them, says C.Ann Wilson, an assistant professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Toronto. She leads the Proclaiming Our Roots project, which collects the histories and experiences of Black and Indigenous Canadians.
I think that there's been, in my opinion, a really deep-seated investment in hiding that history. There's an investment in defining Black history as separate from or something other than Indigenous history versus something that's been very intertwined with and overlapping with Indigenous history.
For his part, Chief Alan Adam also thinks this time will be different and there will be change. At a press conference where he discussed his beating by RCMP officers, he sent a strong message.
Be aware that you are put on notice that this can't continue going on, and it has to stop.
For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Each week on the show, as Election Day draws near, we're profiling a young Latino voter here in the U.S. Our series is called Every 30 Seconds because every 30 seconds a young Latino turns 18 and is eligible to vote. One 17-year-old we've been following is Michelle Aguilar Ramirez. She's a soon-to-be first-time voter in Washington State. Her main concerns are immigration and climate change. Before even casting a ballot, though, Michelle has found herself taking part in a different kind of democracy in the middle of Seattle's protests for racial equality. Reporter Esme Jimenez from KUOW in Seattle brings us this chapter in Michelle's story.
The protests started on a Friday in May.
Ever since, like, the death of George Floyd, it has been, like, a constant stir in my household.
That's Michelle Aguilar Ramirez.
She's a first-generation Guatemalan-American living in South Seattle. Michelle says she and her friends, like many people, are grappling with what they're seeing, not just the police brutality locally and nationally, but how to implement change.
I have a couple of friends who believe that the protests are useless because there's always going to be inequality and injustice in America. I also have other friends who stand with me with the same belief that there needs to be a change made now and we need to demand it in any sort of way.
Michelle has been watching the conversation play out online from home. That's because earlier this year, she tested positive for COVID-19. And some of her family members have recently started showing symptoms too. So out of caution, she hasn't joined the protests. On social media, though, there's a number of different viewpoints.
The majority of the people that are on my Instagram are posting about the Black Lives Matter. They have gone to protests. They have posted petitions. I've also seen a lot of people stay mute, which is sad.
Michelle says it's frustrating to see some of her peers appropriate Black culture, but then not speak out when it comes to systemic issues like racism.
I have faced my own share of racism. So the minimal that I can do is go protest. The minimal that I can do is sign petitions, donate money, vote, text, call, email. I believe that my place in the movement is to become an advocate for my Black brothers and sisters.
She's also having these conversations at home. Michelle is talking to her family members about what it means to be Latino and an ally to the Black Lives Matter movement. But it hasn't been easy.
I don't like having these kind of conversations with my family members simply because I know there's deep-rooted racism.
And the news media doesn't help. Michelle says Spanish language stations like Univision and Telemundo aren't telling the whole story.
Esas son las vergonzosas imágenes que han empañado el reclamo de justicia para George Floyd. Esta mujer salió de una tienda cargando algunos pares de zapatos.
In this Univision segment, the reporter calls the looting shameful as a Black woman walks away from a store with a pair of shoes.
Both of these platforms are showing only the bad parts of the protesting, you know, the looting, the riots.
And these stations are where her family gets most of their news. So she hopes there's better coverage in the future. Michelle says during these last few months, she's also come to another realization.
The whole movement overall has impacted me on how exactly my vote amplifies the voices of others. I can't stay mute just because I don't like certain candidates that are up, because I'd rather have something that fits most of the things that I believe in instead of having nothing and staying voiceless.
Before the primary, Michelle supported Senator Bernie Sanders. When he dropped from the race, she was lukewarm about former Vice President Joe Biden. Then the pandemic hit, and she lost the bandwidth to stay connected to politics and wasn't sure if she'd even vote. But the protest reignited her commitment.
I think I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. There's a couple things that are iffy here and there, but, you know, I prefer him than something else.
While Washington State does not have the Latino voting power of places like Florida or California, it ranks among the top 15 states when it comes to the number of eligible Latino voters. Roughly 400,000 Latinos are eligible to vote here. And Michelle will be one of them come November. For The World, I'm Esme Jimenez in Seattle.
Sarah Higazi will be remembered as someone who just wanted to be herself. But just being herself, a lesbian in Egypt, became tormenting. She moved to Canada, where she was given political asylum. This past weekend, Sarah took her life. It was just 3 years ago when she went to a music festival in Cairo. She felt the spirit of the moment, had a rainbow flag with her, and raised it above the crowd. That came back to haunt her, says her close friend, Aya Hijazi. Both women have been activists and spent time in Egyptian prisons. I asked Aya about that moment when Sarah Hijazi unfurled the rainbow flag at the concert. And what happened after she took that joyous and brave decision?
She told us, I always felt repressed and not able to express myself. And I wasn't trying to make any political statements. I wasn't being courageous. I was just joyous.
So, Aya, take us back to 2017, if you would, and that moment when a friend of Sarah's snapped that picture in what became an iconic photograph. The Lebanese pop band Mashru Leila just taken the stage at a festival in Cairo. What happened?
Right, of course, and he raised that flag. And then Some people put it on social media. It wasn't her. And then after the people posted it, it was a week later that she was arrested. She was sexually harassed by the authorities. And she was like asked very private questions. She was electrocuted and she was tortured just because of raising the flag, nothing else.
Yeah, which was a horrible experience and a complete 180 from the kind of jubilation that she was feeling at that concert, right?
I think that was the last moment of joy she ever felt. She was taken afterwards to solitary confinement as well. And then she was placed with just two women in a cell, and they were forbidden from talking to her. And then ultimately, of course, she was deported and made to leave Egypt, and her mother died as well. And so she just felt depressed afterwards.
How did Sarah get out of prison in Cairo?
There was advocacy for her case, and then she was just released. She wasn't acquitted, and then she was basically deported, never allowed to go back home. And I want to say that she never felt comfortable living in exile, and she told us repeatedly that she wants to go back home, even if she's going to go back to prison.
So she then struggled with depression, and she took her life this past Saturday. What's been the reaction in Cairo to her death?
I mean, it is mixed, but an unequal mix, with 90% of the people just being vile. And then a fellow activist and a friend said if this was 10, 15 years ago, no one would have been outspoken in her support. But now that like even 10% are able to be outspoken and really speak their opinion freely about the issue and even changing their profiles to the rainbow flag, that is very taboo. That is change. And we think this change is made by Sarah. So she left, but I think her legacy for rights and freedoms and peace and love will live past her.
Aya, we've been reflecting on the Supreme Court decision here in the U.S. to support protection for LGBTQ people in the workplace. Clearly, different countries are seeing the urgency for LGBTQ equality and justice through different lenses. When you think about what needs to be accomplished in Egypt, where do you even begin?
In America, all of this happens, even legislations, you know, banning discrimination. It's because of democracy. It is because there is freedom of speech. And you can't have rights if you have, you know, if you're ruled by a tank and a gun.
So Hamid Sino, the lead singer of Mashru Leila, the band that Sarah went to see in Cairo in 2017, he actually sang a few stanzas in Sarah's honor once he learned about her death. These are lines that she actually posted online before she took her life. And the couplet goes, "The sky is more beautiful than the earth, and I want the sky, not the earth." And it's really poignant. Aya, you spoke about the legacy of Sarah. What do activists in the Mideast do with this moment?
So people are arranging vigils for her in Beirut. They've already lit candles for her yesterday, even in Syria, a conflict that is like in Syria, it's war torn, right? And people are dying indeed. Because she was a staunch supporter of Syria, Syrian activists did a vigil for her and raised banners. A lot of people really loved her and came out in support of LGBTQ rights. And this was the first time that I seen Egypt people changing their profiles to the rainbow flag.
Aya Hijazi, thank you very much for telling us about your late friend, Sarah Hijazi. We really appreciate your time. And again, our condolences.
Thank you.
Eusebius McIsaac wants white people to feel uncomfortable, or at least be willing to feel uncomfortable. McIsaac is South African, mixed race. He's 41 and grew up during the tail end of apartheid. Today, he's popular across South Africa as an author, commentator, broadcaster, and podcaster. McIsaac's on-air interview style is to ask the questions you may be too afraid to ask. He wants to reach people beyond just the politically woke. Eusebius McIsaac joins me via Skype from Johannesburg. Eusebius, the anger, the protests against police brutality on African Americans in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd, they've got plenty of energy right now. They spread to many other parts of the globe. They don't seem to be stopping. What do you think is going on here? Is this a moment that is sustainable? And if it is, does that tell you something deeper is happening?
I think it is a moment, but it's a moment that must be connected to history. There's institutionalized anti-black racism across the globe. I think because of the pandemic, ironically enough, we have an opportunity to single-mindedly focus on the nature of anti-black racism across the globe. because we don't have the usual complex array of distractions like mass entertainment and sport and the other hurly-burly everyday things that come with life as normal.
You came of age in South Africa as apartheid rule came to an end. So your adult life has essentially been spent living through and watching the transition to the new South Africa. So as you've watched the reaction to this killing of a black man by white police, what aspects of South Africa's transition are relevant, do you think, to the U.S. today?
Sadly, Marco, the answer is that actually South Africa is a very unhelpful case study because we too have institutionalized black racism within the state, even though we have a majority black-led government that is currently in government here at the tip of Africa. And what I mean by that is that black life is so cheap across the globe that even in a region like Africa, you will find post-colonial governments, our own included, that often are at the helm and are responsible for state-led violence against black people. So we too have police brutality. We too have soldiers that are disproportionately trampling on the rights of poor black people in poor areas here in Johannesburg during this pandemic. So there are echoes between what is happening in America and what is happening here in South Africa, notwithstanding the fact that in South Africa, black people are a numerical majority. And what that tells you is that although fundamentally white supremacy is about whiteness, that nevertheless, you can also have post-colonial governments with phenotypically black people in charge who themselves are anti-black.
So we spoke about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recently on our show. It was a process to address past violence during apartheid. It was painful, really painful for a lot of people. But many say the Truth and Reconciliation Commission prevented a civil war. So do you think some sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission is possible for the United States 150 years after the official end of slavery?
A Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the United States is not a good idea, but not because so much time has lapsed after slavery. The reality is that black life continues to be used as part of economic suppression of black people's entitlement to be part of a democratic corporate America. Yeah, to some extent, the TRC in South Africa prevented a civil war, but at what cost? At the cost of economic justice. With the help of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, gave us on the upside was peace, and it gave us civil and political freedoms. What it denied black people was the question of justice, and in particular, economic justice. The reality of the matter is that there's a certain kind of liberal comfort in the language of reconciliation, because reconciliation doesn't of necessity imply reparations. You need to make good by black Americans in terms of the historic injustices, in terms of how their bodies quite literally were used as yet another implement in the making of the American economy that benefited white Americans. Those are material questions that have to be located legally inside the reparations debate, and reconciliation talk is really just a fluffy liberal way of avoiding that conversation.
So I totally hear your point that dealing with the past is a crucial step here. I came upon an interview you did last year with Wilhelm Verwoerd, the grandson of Hendrik Verwoerd, the architect of apartheid and a person who's universally loathed by South Africans today. Let's just hear that exchange.
You have genetically in you the genes of Hendrik Verwoerd. Many South Africans, black and white, regard Hendrik Verwoerd as evil. How do you feel about the fact that you are genetically, through blood, related to the architect of apartheid?
Thank you, Eusebius. I mean, I think that is one of the big questions I'm sitting with in my life, existentially. What does it mean? And not to run away from it.
What were you trying to get at, Eusebius, in asking that question, his blood connection to the father of apartheid?
What I was trying to get at is, in addition to these structural economic justice questions that you and I have managed to frame in this conversation, Marco, there's also an experiential element. I want to know, what do you feel like as a white person? Do you feel the burden of history in terms of being implemented in intergenerational injustice, even if you weren't around in 1948 when your grandfather began the apartheid state formally? And that's a question that many white Americans listening must grapple with.
with. It is possible for you to feel shame, which is a very important moral emotion, even if you are not directly legally accountable for the sins of your father. And I wanted to see whether the grandchildren of Verwoerd, and by extension, metaphorically, white South Africans in general, can grapple with what it means to have intergenerational privileges, even if they were not responsible for the original moral sin.
Mm. What advice would you give Americans on how to have conversations like these?
The most important thing is to stop speaking euphemistically. I find, even with my American friends, when I studied at Oxford, many of them were top scholars who were studying abroad, that there's a kind of careful language here that is framed to avoid speaking plainly. You have to speak plainly. Number two, you have to learn to listen rather than to wait to speak. Learning to listen actively and closely, particularly uncomfortably, what it means to be Black in America right now, it's not easy. It's easy to flip the channel right now and listen to music instead of actually staying with this conversation between you and me. And I think it's incredibly important to allow yourself the habit that you need to form, which is a difficult one, of actually sitting through discomfort. And the last thing I would say is, don't think that if you are a white progressive American simply requires you to speak out against covert racism. Mm. The worst kind of racism in America is the racism of many progressive whites who don't recognize their own spectrum of racisms that they have. So the other problem in American discourse at the moment is that everyone goes for a template of racism that make themselves come out decent. But the truth of the matter is that all white people have work to do, not only the ones who are overt racists.
Eusebius McIsaac is a South African broadcaster and author based in Johannesburg. Eusebius, great to meet and speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. That was absolutely riveting. Thank you.
And that's where we bring things to a close on the radio today. We're always online, though, at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.